Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Your true crime podcast keeps listeners on the edge of their seats. But here's the real mystery. Why isn't it making more money? Odyssey Creator Lab is here to solve that. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on the suspense while our sales team brings in advertisers and revenue. Stop leaving money on the table. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and turn your passion for true crime into real revenue.
Welcome to Radio Rental.
The scariest stories you've ever heard in your life.
All told by real people.
And off we go.
This wasn't a human being that I saw. There's something here in this house. Something not of this world.
There was a woman moving through the hall. I stepped back and I was completely alone.
Radio Rental is available now. Listen for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Steele Talk, and I'm your host, Gerilyn Steele, and I'm very excited about this next interview because, really, he's quite a remarkable man. His name is Dr. John Richard Saylor, and he is joining us. Why? Well, think about it. Minnesota is the land of 14,000 lakes, but what can we learn from lakes? I never thought about that question. Did you? Well, like us, he says, lakes are born, they live, and they die. From their often dramatic formations to their ultimate disappearances, lakes live extraordinary lives. John Richard Saylor, PhD, traces the natural history of these remarkable still waters in his new book, Lakes, Their Birth, Life, and Death. Dr. Saylor is a professor of mechanical engineering at Clemson University, and he has researched the phenomena that occur at the interface between air and water. He joins us now on the John Schuster Coldwell Banker Hotline. Welcome so much, Dr. Saylor. Welcome to Steele Talkin'.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Gerilyn.
How did it ever come to be that you found this interesting? Is this something as a young boy that you thought, hey, fascinating?
No, not at all. As you probably imagine, a professor of mechanical engineering doesn't normally do research on lakes. It's not really in our wheelhouse.
Right.
But I happened to get involved in a project studying the evaporation of water from lake surfaces. And it was sort of a red herring kind of project. And when it came time to get this published, to write a paper summarizing our results, I found myself in the position of having to get spun up on lakes, at least so I knew the vocabulary and could write a paper on it. And probably like most of your readers, I thought lakes were great. It's great to vacation on them, swim in them, canoe in them, et cetera. But I didn't think they were, fascinating or anything like that. I just thought they were pleasant places to be. But in the process of learning about lakes, I kept finding fascinating, wonderful things about them, mysterious things about them, and even things about them which are frankly quite dangerous.
You are a prolific writer, and I know that you have probably thought, my goodness, I did not see this for my life. Most people like you would say, I didn't see this for my life. Yet this is so fascinating to even me. I didn't know any of this. And as I've been researching and watching videos of you and trying to figure out, all the questions I want to ask you, tell me what is most important about your research when it comes to lakes.
So I think that the thing in the book that I think is most fascinating regarding lakes is a specific kind of lakes called the Carolina Bays. Now these don't exist in Minnesota. They exist on the East Coast, anywhere from southern New Jersey to northern Florida. And Carolina Bays are lakes that are perfectly elliptical and lakes that, as ellipses, have their long axis all pointed in the same direction. And they're kind of fascinating because we still don't know exactly how they were formed, why they have this incredible elliptical shape. And this was one of the things that really spurred me on to write the book. I remember the first, and I encourage your listeners to do what I'm about to tell you I did, which was to go to Google Maps and look at a certain part of North Carolina where there are a whole lot of these Carolina Bays. So if your listeners were to enter Elizabethtown, North Carolina, it's just a small town that has a whole lot of these Carolina Bays right near it. If you enter that and go into the satellite view, you'll see what I saw, which is these endless series of these gorgeous ellipses. Many of these are, in fact, green because the lakes were drained and have since filled in with vegetation. But there's just all these beautiful green ellipses everywhere, and I was just sort of, you know, shocked by that I lived nearby there and didn't even know that they ever existed. And it's just one of the fascinating things that spurred me on to write the book.
It is absolutely fascinating. I had a chance to watch your video, and knowing that they're all pointing in the same direction as well, same color, same shape, pointing in the same direction. I have so many questions when I get to heaven. Okay, so as we sit and listen to your brilliance, sir, really, I'm just thrilled that you exist on this planet. I know that there are lakes we're really concerned about today, whether it's Salt Lake City in Utah, their right. Great Salt Lake, Tahoe City, California, Lake Tahoe, Lake Michigan in Chicago, and of course, right here in our own backyard, Lake Superior in Duluth. When you look at those, what have you gleaned about their coming death? Right, we know right. that they exist, they are living currently, but is obviously a death is ahead of them. And how do you know when to write that or when to talk about that?
So, I mean, the death of a lake is normally something which takes a very long time. So thousands and thousands of years is the process by which a lake will naturally become eliminated. And this occurs via a very simple process. It's just a simple fact that the flows into lakes carry sediment, and that sediment will settle out when the flow slows down. And so bit by bit, millimeter by millimeter, lakes tend to silt in or fill up, and that's often the demise of a lake, but not something that's going to occur in our lifetime. But when humans get in the picture, then things can happen very rapidly. And you referred to several very large lakes just a moment ago, Lake Michigan and Lake Superior. And, you know, with our Great Lakes, We're you know, in the U.S., we're blessed with this enormous body of water, just one of the largest bodies of fresh water on planet Earth. And one could be tempted to think that that's, you know, effectively a limitless supply, but nothing could be, you know, further from the truth. I think something I really learned in the process of writing this book is that as big as lakes can be, our thirst for the water in them is much larger, and probably the best example of that would be the Aral Sea. The Aral Sea is actually a lake. It's located in the boundary between Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, and it was once one of the largest lakes on Earth. I think the fourth largest lake, perhaps by area. And in the 1960s, the then Soviet Union began an irrigation project to get crops, fiber, and food crops growing on the shores of the Aral Sea, and so it diverted significant quantities of the rivers that fed that sea, and the process was just devastating. The sea shrank to I think 1/10 of its original size. It's an incredible natural disaster, man-made disaster that occurred because the water line receded so far, hundreds of kilometers in some cases, that what was left behind was just desiccated earth. And the Aral Sea is a saline lake, so the lake bed that was left behind was a salty lake bed, so vegetation didn't grow on it very well. And any wind resulted in very large dust storms, which caused enormous health problems with the surrounding population. Exacerbated because the dry lake bed also had now precipitated herbicides and pesticides from the agricultural activities on the shore. So this just caused an incredible natural disaster, and it was due, you know, simply to diverting the flow into the Aral Sea for irrigation. And we're seeing a similar thing happen. You mentioned Salt Lake City. That's happening with our Great Salt Lake. Very similar thing is occurring. The population in that area is, of course, growing, and more water is diverted to provide water resources for that thirsty population. And if you combine that with a reduction in snow melt and stream flow, you get the same sort of thing. The shore of the lake subsides, and you can have once again severe dust storms and other problems that occur when a lake dries up.
So in your research, have you discovered that there are some lakes that die and have a rebirth?
Well, certainly that can occur. So and there's good news with the RLC. I mean, the disaster is attention is being focused to it. There is great effort to get flow from the rivers back to the sea, and so I am optimistic that sea is going to one day return to its former self.
Okay, so when we look at lakes from this specific perspective, what do you want us to take with this? How do we protect our lakes? Why is it that we don't care enough to do more, or is it that we don't know what to do?
I think it's just, once again, if you look at the Great Lakes, right? I mean, if you've spent any time along them, even if you're not, if you're just driving along their shore. I remember when I used to live in Minnesota, I took a visit to the North Shore, and I mean, it feels like you're driving forever along this incredibly large lake. And so I think it's very tempting to think, well, you know, this is just a natural resource that we simply can't ever dry up. But the point of the matter is we can. And with the Great Lakes, attempts have been done to do that, you know, to divert water from the Great Lakes via pipelines, to send them any number of places to try to alleviate droughts in various areas. I think this was proposed in places everywhere from New York City to Los Angeles. And I think the thing to recognize is that sort of thing can have profound damaging consequences. Now, I think that, you know, I'd like to look at good news, and some very good news in North America is that our Great Lakes are now protected by a compact between the United States and Canada. So there is now in law the requirement that any use of Great Lakes water can only occur in counties that are within the watershed of the Great Lakes, and this is a great thing because it ensures that no matter how much water is withdrawn in those counties, that water ultimately will find its way back to the lakes, effectively, I won't say ensuring, but making it very, very unlikely that they will be desiccated in the way that has occurred in other lakes.
We have with our rivers convergences, right, across the world, really. I think there may be 10 to 15, you would know better. But when it comes to lakes, we don't have something like that necessarily. And I'm just wondering if we keep building or offering these man-made lakes. We have quite a few of them here in the Twin Cities and the state of Minnesota, as you well know. Is that hurting or helping our lakes to have man-made lakes?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question. The first thing to recognize is that human beings are really prolific lake builders. And the archaeological record suggests that humans have been building dams, making lakes since biblical times. As soon as human beings slowed down, settled down, and decided to start planting and staying in one place, it seems that not long after that, we decided to build a dam to ensure we'd have water nearby. If you go to Spain, there are actually working, functional dams there that are holding water back that were built by the Romans in the first or second century A.D. So we do a lot of that. There's just an awful lot of human-made lakes out there, and there's real pluses and minuses for that. So the real pluses are that death due to flooding in places where dams are built to control that is highly minimized, and that's a great thing. It also ensures that we have water in times of drought, or at least mitigates any problems caused by drought. But what can also happen, and what has happened in several large river systems, is that we've impounded so much water that the river actually never makes it to the sea. So the classic example of that would have to be the Colorado River. So we have so many impoundments along that river, and we withdraw so much water from it that the Colorado River, which once entered the Gulf of California, you know, it's just a mighty torrent, now barely enters that with a trickle, if at all. And that process is happening in many other places. It happens certain times of the year at the Rio Grande. There's several rivers in Australia and other places where that happens. And so the real problem with that is the loss of a river ecosystem. So there are fish species and other organisms that require that white water. You know, they require that highly oxygenated water for as part of their life cycle. And the stretches of rivers that have that are becoming shorter and shorter as we choose to impound more and more water.
So how much carbon dioxide can a lake absorb, and for how long?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I think when we talk about climate change, you know, carbon dioxide sequestration by lakes is probably somewhat of a smaller player when we compare, you know, when we compare to the ocean, right? So the ocean is just, you know, such a large surface area compared to the surface area of lakes. But it's not insignificant, and part of the reason for that is that there are a lot of very small lakes. So when we look at lake surface area, if you only count the larger lakes, which had been done for quite some time, you sort of underestimate the CO2 sequestration by lakes. But if you include the very small lakes, I mean the things that are perhaps a hectare or smaller, that number of the surface area gets larger, and the sequestration there can become more significant. You mentioned carbon dioxide. There's an interesting thing I talk about in the book, which is that carbon dioxide, when it's emitted from the ground and dissolves into the bottom waters of a lake, it can cause a very dangerous phenomenon, which is called a limnic eruption. And this occurred at a lake called Lake Nyos in Cameroon in 1986, where the carbon dioxide that was dissolved in the bottom of the lake came out of solution. All the bubbles, all the carbon dioxide came out as a gas all at once on the night of August 21st in 1986, and a massive amount of CO2 was released, as much as, I think, a quarter of a cubic mile, and it rushed down the slopes and killed 1,746 people in their sleep in the villages below. Mm-hmm. So this is just one example of how lakes are, they can be fascinating, they can be mysterious, but they also can be dangerous, something perhaps that we don't think about.
We have 2 minutes left, sir, and I'm just wondering about something you said, that beneath the surface of the many lakes that populate our planet lie wonderful secrets. Tell me, give me one example of a wonderful secret.
I think one of the most interesting secrets is that lakes exist in places you'd never imagine. So one of the best examples of that are subglacial lakes. So there are lakes in Antarctica that exists beneath 2 miles of ice. If you go down through 2 miles of ice, you'll hit a lake. There are lakes, hundreds of lakes there. One called Lake Vostok is about the size of Lake Ontario. It's enormous. And the water in that lake has not seen the atmosphere in as many as 10 million years.
Oh,
so it's water that was last exposed to air when dinosaurs were walking around, which I think is just a fascinating thing to think about.
Well, you are fascinating, sir. It has been a pleasure having you join us, Dr. John Richard Saylor. Thank you so much. The name of the book is Lakes, Their Birth, Life, and Death. Run to get the book. I know I will be. Thank you again, sir, for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me, Geraldine. It's been a real pleasure.
A real pleasure. Thank you, sir. All right, as I take a deep breath and go over all that he taught us, let's take a break. We'll come back.
Ah, DSW, Earthplace of the Humble Brag. Here, the shoes are so good, no one would ever know how little you paid. If you didn't go telling everyone, that is. And with never-ending options for every style, mood, and occasion, all at really great prices, we'll definitely give you something to brag about. So go ahead, stock up on fresh sneakers from your favorite brands. Or try those boots you always secretly knew you could pull off. Find the shoes that get you at prices that get your budget at DSW stores or at DSW.com. Let us surprise you.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here, wishing you a very happy half-off holiday, because right now, Mint Mobile is offering you the gift of 50% off unlimited. To be clear, that's half price, not half the service. If Mint is still premium unlimited wireless for a great price. So, that means a half day, yeah? Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan, equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speeds slow after 35 gigabytes if network's busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. It's about getting the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. And to find candidates who match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. Stop struggling to get your job post even seen on other sites. Give your job the best chance to be seen with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. They help you stand out and hire quality candidates who can drive the results you need. Sponsored Jobs boost your post for quality candidates, so you can reach the exact people you want faster. Join the 1.6 million companies that sponsor their jobs with Indeed. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Your true crime podcast keeps listeners on the edge of their seats. But here's the real mystery. Why isn't it making more money? Odyssey Creator Lab is here to solve that. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on the suspense, while our sales team brings in advertisers and revenue. Stop leaving money on the table. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and turn your passion for true crime into real revenue.
Welcome back to Steel Talkin'. So great to have you join us tonight. Thank you to every one of our listeners. I do want to mention about this incredible Mr. Saylor. He, to me, is quite remarkable. And I know that Minnesota is the land of 14,000 lakes, I believe we have about now. But what can we learn from lakes is really important. And I think most of us, you know, those that can, get the book, get as much information as you can. Because, you know, he talks about those lakes being born and living and dying and actually having, you know, life, enjoying the life. I that's how I see it in my mind as he was talking. And he talks about exploring lakes from around the world. He takes the readers on a journey, it says in his book, to some of the most fascinating lakes, like Antarctica's Lake Vostok, whose water hasn't been exposed to the atmosphere in perhaps a million years, but he mentioned one that said 10 million years. Lake Baikal, the deepest and oldest lake in the world, formed from a rift in the Earth's crust in Siberia, and the so-called Killer Lake. You ever heard of that, Jonathan? Killer Lake?
I tend to try to stay away from killer lakes. Most things with the word word killer in the phrase, try to stay away from that. Now,
also
if it was killer with an A instead of an ER, then maybe I'd be down with that. But with an ER at the end,
did you say you'd be down with that? Did you say you'd be down with that?
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah,
that is my generation.
It's true. Okay, so the so-called Killer Lake, or Lake Nias, which exploded in 1986 and caused hundreds of deaths. Did you know a lake could explode? I mean, I'm assuming it's, I can't even imagine that. I know that a volcano explodes, but that's fire. How in the world does this explode?
I don't think I knew about it until recently, and I was telling you about this during the break. There was a former TV show, actually on CBS, called Scorpion, and it followed a team of geniuses based on the life, the story of this gentleman who's alive, who's living, and he's, I believe, got the highest recorded IQ in the world, or one of the top three or five. And he built a team of geniuses to go around solving problems and issues. And on one particular episode, this gentleman, who the real-life guy is from Ireland and the actor who played him was from Ireland as well, they went back to Ireland to visit their, you know, the family, and he's kind of an outcast from the village, but he notices in a lake outside of town that there is a carbon dioxide bubble that's building on the bottom of the lake.
Mm.
And so they have to try to, I guess, kind of – they have to drain that gas from the lake so that it doesn't explode into a situation that happening – like the one that happened in Cameroon. I won't give away the end of the story, but I would be stunned – if they did not pull from that Cameroon tragedy as part of that episode. I'd be stunned if they didn't, because I thought I remembered hearing about that incident, but I had forgotten that it happened.
Well, this man has, you know, studied or learned so much about so many of the lakes in our not just our country, but beyond even. You know, in Atlanta, they have the Lake Lanier. And I think that was the one where almost all of the lake was gone and they found all of these artifacts, you know, stuck in the mud, and people would walk way out into the middle of that lake and try to, you know, take stuff home. And the state of Georgia, the government was like, can't do that. We own all of that. You know, they were trying to stop people. But it's amazing. Our lakes are amazing. I will look at lakes from a completely different perspective now that I've done this interview with this remarkable man. All right, we're going to take a break and then come back with some weather in a moment. Welcome back, everyone. I'm excited. I believe it was last Sunday or the Sunday before we tried to have Andrea Jenkins, council member, on to discuss cultural districts in Minneapolis, and she is joining us tonight. How are you, Andrea, with your busy self?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
I'm doing well. My goodness, we've been through a lot since 2020, and you've been at the forefront of some of this. And I'm really curious about cultural districts in Minneapolis. I had heard about them before, read a little bit about them, but can you give us the definition of what a cultural district is?
Well, good evening, Geraldine, and to all of your listeners out there. I'm honored and delighted to be here with you today, and that we could finally make it work. Cultural districts are parts of town that reflect a certain cultural identity. So, for example, you know, a lot of people travel around, and almost every city has a Chinatown. I think that would be considered a cultural district. And, you know, in Atlanta, there's sort of the MLK and, you know, sort of all the things that are associated with the King household and Ebenezer Church. Like, that's a cultural district. But here in Minneapolis, how we have defined cultural districts is a community or a corridor. In fact, we define it as a corridor. So one contiguous street that represents a particular culture, and then the city of Minneapolis will try to uplift and support that culture through business and economic development activities, through supporting cultural activities such as, so for example, Broadway Avenue is a designated cultural district, mm-hmm. and one of the things that they do annually is an event called Flow, and so the city, we will try to support that kind of activity by waiving fees for police
protection
and, you know, closing off the street and, you know, getting those waivers that you kind of need to pay for to make those things happen. We also target our program called the Commercial Property Development Fund, which helps small business owners to purchase properties that they have their business in, but they don't necessarily own the property. And we only target those funds to cultural districts. So we have seven cultural districts in the city of Minneapolis. One is the 38th Street corridor, which is unfortunately now where George Floyd was murdered.
Yes.
But we have been, you know, that's been a African-American cultural district for decades and decades. So we're really trying to highlight and uplift the contributions that African-Americans have made to this city, particularly along 38th Street. Another cultural district is Lake Street. Then you go down to Franklin, which is a Native American sort of cultural district.
Mm-hmm.
Cedar Riverside, Somali, Broadway is a more African American cultural district, and Central Avenue. And so Central Avenue and Lowry Avenue. So these are some of the cultural districts that we have identified in the city, and we try to prioritize resources, prioritize technical assistance, and really try to highlight and uplift the cultural events that define those communities.
Yeah, I think what surprised me the most about this is that city officials really felt that the desires of the community members really wanted to prevent displacement of residents in gentrifying areas. And I was, you know, it just kind of shook me when I read that, because we know that in so many of these cultural districts, gentrification is real and it is happening, right? So with that said, do the cultural districts stop displacement of residents?
Well, you know, we hope it does. You know, I'm not sure if there's one specific way to stop displacement, although I would say that probably the biggest way to try to stop displacement is through ownership, right? And so therein comes our Commercial Property Development Fund, which we try to help small business owners who have been in the community, who represent cultural communities, to purchase the building and properties that they live on. In addition, we have home ownership opportunities for homeowners along and around those cultural districts to try to ensure that we don't let gentrification displace, long-term community members. It's very much a deep concern, and I think we've recognized that and really trying to bring in some tools to help eliminate that. And like I said, I think home ownership and ownership, period, is one way to really combat displacement.
So what type of tools are you speaking of?
So one is the Commercial Development Property Loan Fund.
Mm-hmm.
We also have home ownership opportunities and home ownership support for.
We do, because over here in North Minneapolis, there are so many seniors that have been losing their homes over, you know, maybe a decade or so. And it's really disturbing to me. So I know that we're looking out for, we're trying to define and watch out for all of the changes that are happening in these cultural districts. But I do want to talk a little bit about the Minneapolis 2040 plan. I was just telling my in-studio producer earlier tonight, there's always a plan, and they plan way out, you know, to make sure there's plenty of time for them to get done what they want to get done. Would you agree with that?
I do agree with that. So, you know, the 2040 plan, so just for pure context, each city in the state is required to submit a 10-year plan every 10 years and submit that to the Metropolitan Council or to the state of Minnesota. So you have to say, how are we going to manage building housing, economic development, sewers and roads in the next 10 years. The 2040 plan that I think you're referring to is what we're calling the Minneapolis 2040 plan. And that was really designed to, again, help with the displacement that you talked about. By building more housing, we're able to lower the cost of housing in the city. And up until now, there have been sort of rules and zoning regulations that says Minneapolis can only build single-family housing. And if you want to build multifamily housing, you have to get waivers and variances, and there's only certain places that you can do this. And so what we did, what the 2040 plan does, is eliminate those zoning regulations and allows you to build duplexes, triplexes, multifamily homes all over the city. The practice of only building single-family homes was a way to keep white neighborhoods white. You know, if you only have single-family homes and then you redline and you sort of obstruct people's opportunity to purchase, you can keep the community white. You know, I've been thinking a lot about Lorraine Hansberry and her play Raisin in the Sun. Mm. And that was, you know, that was a part of the younger family's challenge, right? Is that they couldn't buy a house in the white neighborhood. I mean, they had challenges anyway. And that has been a real reality here in Minneapolis. So the 2040 plan, which right now the city is being sued for by people who want to maintain the status quo. And, you know, so we are litigating that in court. I think the city is going to prevail. And
well, I tell you, I'm surprised that these are seven, excuse me for interrupting, but these seven mm-hmm. cultural districts, are we ever going to add more of them?
You know, I mean, I think they are really connected to, we try to do our homework up front. So we have it where we have low income tracts based on census tracts, and other, there's a process called ACP50, which stands for Areas of Concentrated Poverty. Mm. So we looked all around the city, and these were the areas where we found that those realities were happening. There's not a lot of other places where that is going on. And if we have so many, if everything is a cultural district, then it really doesn't mean much, right? So I think we want to limit cultural districts at this point and try to really understand how they are functioning and how they are working. And if we need to, I think that's something that we can look at and think about in the future. But right now, I think that we have them in the right place, Broadway, Lake Street, Cedar Riverside, Franklin Avenue, again, the Native American community, 38th in Chicago, which is African American community, which I represent. It includes Sabathany Community Center, George Floyd Square, so many black and brown owned businesses that used to be there that are coming back. You know, so I think we have them in some pretty good places. I will not say that there shouldn't be opportunities to have more in the future.
Thank you
right
for that.
Now,
that's what I was waiting for. Because here's the deal. When you said that funds are being are involved in this, then we should absolutely
sure.
have more. If there are funds where we could really make a statement with one of the cultural districts, you know, a new one that's coming forward, that sort of thing, why not? Mm-hmm. Why not ask for more? Because really, it's the people that live in these cultural districts that have an understanding of what that means and has an understanding, they have an understanding of what living in those districts really mean to them. So that's important.
Sure.
So even if we have seven right now, if we get, maybe three more, I'm not upset about that. If there's funding for it, I would love to see that, because it really does move people to say, I live in this cultural district and it means a lot to me. And I've heard that before.
Yeah, no, that's real. That's very real. And, we've been kind of on the neighborhood process in the city of Minneapolis, but never really having districts. And so, but it's also, so like we have the Northeast District, and I mean, what do you call it? The North Loop.
Yeah.
You know, that's
the North Loop. Okay.
But they don't really need the resources, right? I mean, it's a pretty stable income community. And while it is a cultural district, there's the baseball stadium, the basketball, the food, the restaurants, theaters, and entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't need resources. Broadway, Lake Street, they need that kind of support.
Exactly. I've been reading from an article that's called A History of the Minneapolis Cultural Districts by Tiffany Bowie. And it's really important for us to know exactly what it means when you say cultural districts. I will say that they consider this a national movement to create cultural districts. In fact, in the article, it says cultural districts are a global phenomenon and they come in all shapes and sizes. There are 19 states that have formal cultural district programs like Iowa, Louisiana, and Rhode Island. They were early adopters of the policy, according to Tom Borup, who wrote his doctoral dissertation on cultural districts. So for me, when you read something like that, that means not enough of us know about cultural districts. And it's something I would love to hear more about and maybe even talk more about on my show. And I'm just hoping that...
Tom is local, right? You know, Tom Borup lives in this community, lives and works here. He's married to Harry Waters Jr., who I think you may know or be familiar with. And so, I would love to come on and talk with Tom and you and talk about
the district. We'll see if we can make that happen. I'm so sorry we run out of time, Andrea. Thank you so much for joining us. Councilmember Andrea Jenkins has been joining us, and I really appreciate you giving us your thoughts. You take care of yourself.
Thank you so much. Have a great evening.
You too. All right, we're going to take a break and we'll be back soon. Welcome back, everyone. We just have a few seconds here, and I just want to let you know, Center Stage is next. All things arts and entertainment. We just believe you ought to know about it. Sandy Bourne Barrett is going to start it out. She's the artistic director of Stages Theater Company and director of what? The Little Mermaid Junior. What is Junior? Can't wait to find out. Stay tuned.
DSW, Earth Place of the Humble Brag. Here, the shoes are so good, no one would ever know how little you paid. If you didn't go telling everyone, that is. And with never-ending options for every style, mood, and occasion, all at really great prices, we'll definitely give you something to brag about. So go ahead, stock up on fresh sneakers from your favorite brands. Or try those boots you always secretly knew you could pull off. Find the shoes that get you at prices that get your budget at DSW stores or at DSW.com. Let us surprise you.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. One of the perks about having four kids that you know about is actually getting a direct line to the big man up north.
Mm-hmm.
And this year, he wants you to know the best gift that you can give someone is the gift of Mint Mobile's unlimited wireless for $15 a month. Now, you don't even need to wrap it. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speed slow after 35 gigabytes of networks busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. It's about getting the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. And to find candidates who match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. Stop struggling to get your job post even seen on other sites. Give your job the best chance to be seen with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. They help you stand out and hire quality candidates who can drive the results you need. Sponsored Jobs boost your post for quality candidates, so you can reach the exact people you want faster. Join the 1.6 million companies that sponsor their jobs with Indeed. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Your true crime podcast keeps listeners on the edge of their seats. But here's the real mystery. Why isn't it making more money? Odyssey Creator Lab is here to solve that. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on the suspense while our sales team brings in advertisers and revenue. Stop leaving money on the table. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and turn your passion for true crime into real revenue.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm excited. I believe it was last Sunday or the Sunday before we tried to have Andrea Jenkins, council member, on to discuss cultural districts in Minneapolis, and she is joining us tonight. How are you, Andrea, with your busy self?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
I'm doing well. My goodness, we've been through a lot since 2020, and you've been at the forefront of some of this. And I'm really curious about cultural districts in Minneapolis. I had heard about them before, read a little bit about them, but can you give us the definition of what a cultural district is?
Well, good evening, Geraldine, and to all of your listeners out there. I'm honored and delighted to be here with you today and that we could finally make it work. Cultural districts are parts of town that reflect a certain cultural identity. So, for example, you know, a lot of people travel around and almost every city has a Chinatown. I think that would be considered a cultural district. And, you know, in Atlanta, there's sort of the MLK and, you know, sort of all the things that are associated with the King household and Ebenezer Church. Like, that's a cultural district. But here in Minneapolis, how we have defined cultural districts is a community or a corridor. In fact, we define it as a corridor. So one contiguous street that represents a particular culture, and then the city of Minneapolis will try to uplift and support that culture through business and economic development activities, through supporting cultural activities such as, so for example, Broadway Avenue is a designated cultural district, mm-hmm. and one of the things that they do annually is an event called Flow, and so the city, we will try to support that kind of activity by waiving fees for police
protection
and, you know, closing off the street and, you know, getting those waivers that you kind of need to pay for to make those things happen. We also target our program called the Commercial Property Development Fund, which helps small business owners to purchase properties that they have their business in, but they don't necessarily own the property. And we only target those funds to cultural districts. So we have seven cultural districts in the city of Minneapolis. One is the 38th Street corridor, which is unfortunately now where George Floyd was murdered.
Yes.
But we have been, you know, that's been a African-American cultural district for decades and decades. So we're really trying to highlight and uplift the contributions that African-Americans have made to this city, particularly along 38th Street. Another cultural district is Lake Street. Then you go down to Franklin, which is a Native American sort of cultural district.
Mm-hmm.
Cedar Riverside, Somali, Broadway is a more African American cultural district, and Central Avenue. And so Central Avenue and Lowry Avenue. So these are some of the cultural districts that we have identified in the city, and we try to prioritize resources, prioritize technical assistance, and really try to highlight and uplift the cultural events that define those communities.
Yeah, I think what surprised me the most about this is that city officials really felt that the desires of the community members really wanted to prevent displacement of residents in gentrifying areas. And I was, you know, it just kind of shook me when I read that, because we know that in so many of these cultural districts, gentrification is real and it is happening, right? So with that said, do the cultural districts stop displacement of residents?
Well, you know, we hope it does. You know, I'm not sure if there's one specific way to stop displacement, although I would say that probably the biggest way to try to stop displacement is through ownership, right? And so therein comes our Commercial Property Development Fund, which we try to help small business owners who have been in the community, who represent cultural communities, to purchase the building and properties that they live on. In addition, we have home ownership opportunities for homeowners along and around those cultural districts to try to ensure that we don't let gentrification displace, long-term community members. It's very much a deep concern, and I think we've recognized that and really trying to bring in some tools to help eliminate that. And like I said, I think home ownership and ownership, period, is one way to really combat displacement.
So what type of tools are you speaking of?
So one is the Commercial Development Property Loan Fund.
Mm-hmm.
We also have home ownership opportunities and home ownership support for.
We do, because over here in North Minneapolis, there are so many seniors that have been losing their homes over, you know, maybe a decade or so. And it's really disturbing to me. So I know that we're looking out for, we're trying to define and watch out for all of the changes that are happening in these cultural districts. But I do want to talk a little bit about the Minneapolis 2040 plan. I was just telling my in-studio producer earlier tonight, there's always a plan, and they plan way out, you know, to make sure there's plenty of time for them to get done what they want to get done. Would you agree with that?
I do agree with that. So, you know, the 2040 plan, so just for pure context, each city in the state is required to submit a 10-year plan every 10 years and submit that to the Metropolitan Council or to the state of Minnesota. So you have to say, how are we going to manage building housing, economic development, sewers and roads in the next 10 years. The 2040 plan that I think you're referring to is what we're calling the Minneapolis 2040 plan. And that was really designed to, again, help with the displacement that you talked about. By building more housing, we're able to lower the cost of housing in the city. And up until now, there have been sort of rules and zoning regulations that says Minneapolis can only build single-family housing. And if you want to build multifamily housing, you have to get waivers and variances, and there's only certain places that you can do this. And so what we did, what the 2040 plan does, is eliminate those zoning regulations and allows you to build duplexes, triplexes, multifamily homes all over the city. The practice of only building single-family homes was a way to keep white neighborhoods white. You know, if you only have single-family homes and then you redline and you sort of obstruct people's opportunity to purchase, you can keep the community white. You know, I've been thinking a lot about Lorraine Hansberry and her play Raisin in the Sun. Mm. And that was, you know, that was a part of the younger family's challenge, right? Is that they couldn't buy a house in the white neighborhood. I mean, they had challenges anyway. And that has been a real reality here in Minneapolis. So the 2040 plan, which right now the city is being sued for by people who want to maintain the status quo. And, you know, so we are litigating that in court. I think the city is going to prevail. And
well, I tell you, I'm surprised that these are seven, excuse me for interrupting, but these seven mm-hmm. cultural districts, are we ever going to add more of them?
You know, I mean, I think they are really connected to, we try to do our homework up front. So we have it where we have low income tracts based on census tracts and other, there's a process called ACP50, which stands for Areas of Concentrated Poverty. Mm. So we looked all around the city, and these were the areas where we found that those realities were happening. Mm. There's not a lot of other places where that is going on. And if we have so many, if everything is a cultural district, then it really doesn't mean much, right? So I think we want to limit cultural districts at this point and try to really understand how they are functioning and how they are working. And if we need to, I think that's something that we can look at and think about in the future. But right now, I think that we have them in the right place, Broadway, Lake Street, Cedar Riverside, Franklin Avenue, again, the Native American community, 38th in Chicago, which is African American community, which I represent. It includes Sabathany Community Center, George Floyd Square, so many black and brown owned businesses that used to be there that are coming back. You know, so I think we have them in some pretty good places. I will not say that there shouldn't be opportunities to have more in the future.
Thank you for that. That's what I was waiting for. Because here's the deal. When you said that funds are being are involved in this, then we should absolutely have more. If there are funds where we could really make a statement with one of the cultural districts, you know, a new one that's coming forward, that sort of thing, why not? Mm-hmm. Why not ask for more? Because really, it's the people that live in these cultural districts that have an understanding of what that means and has an understanding, they have an understanding of what living in those districts really mean to them. So that's important. Sure. So even if we have seven right now, if we get, you know, maybe three more, I'm not upset about that. If there's funding for it, I would love to see that, because it really does move people to say, I live in this cultural district and it means a lot to me. And I've heard that before.
Yeah, no, that's real. That's very real. And, you know, we've been kind of on the neighborhood process in the city of Minneapolis, but never really having districts. And so, But it's also, so like, we have the Northeast District, and I mean, what do you call it? The North Loop.
Yeah.
You know, that's
the North Loop, okay.
But they don't really need the resources, right? I mean, it's a pretty stable income community. And while it is a cultural district, there's a baseball stadium, the basketball, the food, the restaurants, theaters, and entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't need resources. Broadway, Lake Street, they need that kind of support.
Exactly. I've been reading from an article that's called A History of the Minneapolis Cultural Districts by Tiffany Bui. And it's really mm-hmm. important for us to know exactly what it means when you say cultural districts. I will say that they consider this a national movement to create cultural districts. In fact, in the article, it says cultural districts are a global phenomenon and they come in all shapes and sizes. There are 19 states that have formal cultural district programs like Iowa, Louisiana, and Rhode Island. They were early adopters of the policy, according to Tom Borup, who wrote his doctoral dissertation on cultural districts. So for me, when you read something like that, that means not enough of us know about cultural districts. And it's something I would love to hear more about and maybe even talk more about on my show. And I'm just hoping that...
Tom is local, right? You know, Tom Borup lives in this community, lives and works mm-hmm. here. He's married to Harry Waters Jr., who I think you may know or be familiar with. And so, you know, I would love to come on and talk with Tom and you and talk about
the district. We'll see if we can make that happen. I'm so sorry we run out of time, Andrea. Thank you so much for joining us. Councilmember Andrea Jenkins has been joining us, and I really appreciate you giving us your thoughts. You take care of yourself.
Thank you so much. Have a great evening.
You too. All right, we're going to take a break and we'll be back soon. Welcome back, everyone. We just have a few seconds here, and I just want to let you know, Center Stage is next. All things arts and entertainment, we just believe you ought to know about it. Sandy Bourne Barrett is going to start it off. She's the artistic director of Stages Theater Company and director of what? The Little Mermaid Junior. What is Junior? Can't wait to find out. Stay tuned.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Your true crime podcast keeps listeners on the edge of their seats. But here's the real mystery. Why isn't it making more money? Odyssey Creator Lab is here to solve that. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on the suspense while our sales team brings in advertisers and revenue. Stop leaving money on the table. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and turn your passion for true crime into real revenue.
Welcome to Radio Rental. The scariest stories you've ever heard in your life. All told by real people. And off we go.
This wasn't a human being that I saw. Just something here in this house. Something not of this world.
There was a woman moving through the hall. I stepped back and I was completely alone.
Radio Rental is available now. Listen for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My new podcast, Crimes Of, explores the forces behind some of the most unforgettable crimes in history. Listen to and follow Crimes Of, available now wherever you get your podcasts.